This is CliffCentral.com.
All right. It's 4-9 Blondes and what's up? What's up?
Can't say hey.
Close the air.
What's going on?
That's the most in tune I've ever heard you sing.
No, it's not really.
Don't Can say I have half a compliment?
Not with singing.
Thanks,
no.
Leanne.
All right. Oh, by the way, today's episode of Blind History, which is coming up later, she's revered all over the world as a saint, but there is more to her story. Mother Teresa devoted her life to the poorest of the poor in a country that she wasn't even born in.
But wasn't there something dodgy about her?
Oh, there are plenty of critics. Intensely pious and dogmatic, she's been criticized in the years since for creating a cult of death and taking money from some unscrupulous characters. But you can find out more by listening to Blind History, which is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters, and you can get all the episodes on cliffcentral.com.
Ooh.
People are enjoying it. So you want to hear about Mother Teresa and all of the good and the bad and the ugly things, then you can go and listen to that podcast. It's available today.
Well, right. I know by the end of it whether I am a supporter or not.
You'll still have to make your own mind up, okay. But I think it's a fairly balanced appraisal of the woman. I mean, she was not this perfect human being. No one is, right? Humans. Mm-hmm. Humans all have faults and flaws. And people have criticized her in the years during her life and after her death for being, you know, not entirely interested in the health of the people she was meant to be looking after. More interested in what happens to their souls once they die.
Oh.
But, you know, you listen to it and you decide. Someone says, oh my God, that song's 26 years old. I might just stay in bed and let that fact sink in.
26 years old. Mm-hmm. Do you know, this year's the 25th year of Kurt Cobain's death.
Yeah.
That was, I read an article and that startled me, but I was 25 years ago.
I listened to Nirvana the other day and I was like, wow, this band, it can't be that long ago. And it is. It's 25 years. 25 years and my life is still. Isn't that ironic? That's the first line of that song. All right. Let's get into some news. There's lots of stuff going on that we need to talk about. Leanne mentioned a woman whose organs were all in the wrong place. I mean, that sounds like a good place to start.
Oh, my goodness me. So imagine it. The faint smell of formaldehyde floating in the air.
Yep.
A medical student and his classmates, mm-hmm. four of them,
mm-hmm.
Prepping a cadaver.
Yes.
In the dissection lab.
It's exciting.
At the Oregon Health and Science University in Portland. Around the room, there's similar groups gathered around other bodies.
Yes.
On 15 other tables, all in this anatomy class, all eager to explore the mysteries of the human body.
Sure.
That they'd only seen in textbooks.
Mm-hmm. And you know what's, you've looked in the textbooks, you know you're going to find the lungs up here in the chest, you're going to find the heart between the lungs, you're going to find the liver on the right-hand side underneath that right lung. You're going to find the spleen underneath the left lung,
mm-hmm.
the stomach between those. You're going to find the intestines, a small intestine in the middle, a large one around the outside.
Mm-hmm. And then the anus.
Kidneys at the back. You go straight to the anus, but yes, the anus at the back, between the cheeks.
Well, the cadaver assigned to this guy, Warren Nielsen and his team, her name, not that they knew at the time, of course, was Rose Marie Bentley, 99 years old, died of natural causes.
Oof.
And so...
She's on the line from heaven.
Oh.
Hello, this is Rose Marie Bentley. How are you?
Hello, Rose.
How are you?
I'm doing well.
Fantastic. I've just got to move my mouth to where my arsehole was, and my arsehole to where my mouth was, and then my ear holes are going to go where my eyes are.
Oh,
everything was all over the place, as I recall.
Well, the good thing for you, Rosemarie Bentley, is that they diagnosed what was wrong with you.
Well, I was already dead, so not much use, but yes. Would have been nice if I'd got an extra few years because they worked this out while I was still alive, wouldn't you think?
Oh, well, my. You were a very special woman and you served well for science, so thank you for donating your body to science.
Why don't you tell them what they found?
Okay, well, she'd certainly deserved her own unique spot in medical literature and history books. She had a condition called situs inversus.
Ooh, that's the worst.
With levocardia. in which most vital organs are reversed, almost like a mirror inside the body.
So in other words, everything I described, opposite.
Yes, he was a sort of medical unicorn. The chance of finding someone like her, 1 in 50 million.
Mm.
So what happened was the first organ that they were going to examine was the heart.
Mm-hmm.
So they opened the body's chest cavity.
Yeah.
And it wasn't long before the group began to notice that there was no inferior vena cava. That's the large vein that's normally on the right side of the heart. And the whole team said, they called their professor. They said, are we missing it? Are we crazy? And they kind of rolled their eyes, and the other students did, and said, how can these students miss such a big vessel? The professor came over, and that's when all the hubbub started. He was like, oh, my God, this is completely backwards.
Hmm. Bass-ackwards.
So, yeah, the typical body has this big vena cava that follows the right side of the vertebral column,
mm-hmm.
curving under the liver and emptying deoxygenated blood into the heart.
Mm-hmm.
But this vein instead was on the left, and instead of terminating directly into the heart, her vein continued through her diaphragm, along the thoracic vertebra, up and around and over the aortic arch, and emptied to the right side of her heart.
Jesus.
But that wasn't the only irregularity.
Irregularity, yeah.
What else was irregularity? Numerous veins that drain the liver and other parts of the chest were either missing completely or sprouting from unusual spots. Her right lung had only 2 lobes instead of the standard 3. The right atrium of her heart was twice the normal size. Instead of the stomach on the left, her stomach was on the right.
Wow.
The liver, which normally occurs predominantly on the right, was more predominant on the left.
Wow.
Spleen on the right instead of the left.
Uh-huh.
The rest of the digestive tract was inverted as well, including both colons. And the list goes on and on. She was completely backwards inside.
And she lived to 99.
Absolutely. One of 4 kids, long happy life, born in 1918 in a small town, and lived a long happy life.
Well, there we go. You see, even if you're bass-ackwards, doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to die young.
And it was her husband who convinced her to become a body donor, who just said he thought it was the greatest thing.
Can you imagine if those students who were doing the dissection on her, if they were marked on that one and they got it all wrong? And they all failed medical school, but it was because she was a freak, not because they were wrong.
And they had to say, but look, please.
Professor,
we really aren't being crazy here.
The professor's like, no, you've got everything wrong, guys. Sorry, you're all failed. All out. Get out of medical school. Sorry.
Yeah. But the woman.
No, I'm sorry.
Well, imagine, she obviously had never had major surgery in her life. Mm-hmm. Imagine the poor cardiothoracic surgeon who opened her up.
Oh.
And had to do a bypass.
I'm looking for your WTF. Superior vena cava, and I'm finding your vagina.
Yeah. Like, her stomach isn't here, I promise. Yeah. I've looked.
Wow. All right.
That's amazing.
Yes, it is amazing. So, you know, you might, this morning you might not be feeling special.
You might have
your organs in all the wrong places.
But
maybe
also,
you are special.
Don't trust it when people say if you have a pain on your right, it's your appendix, because maybe yours is on the left.
This is not what I want
to
hear.
Could be one in those million, billion people.
1 in 50 million.
Who's got everything the wrong way around.
I'm trying to feel for things, making sure everything is in the right place.
That's not very deep. You're feeling your nipples at this point.
Excuse me. I'll put my shirt back on then.
All right. So while we're talking about health, there are so many new devices and apps and all these kinds of things that we have now that we are able to use to diagnose ourselves. I've got a blood pressure monitor in the office that someone gave me a while ago, and you attach it to your wrist, mm-hmm. and then it blows up just like those
old school ones
that they use. Yeah, and then they release the valve, but they measure your blood pressure. So this thing is a very accurate blood pressure monitor.
It's quite a nifty contraption you have there.
You could check it out, and it gives you a very accurate reading on your diastolic and your systolic blood pressure.
And it even sends it to you over mail.
Correct.
Gives you a nice analysis.
Right. But the problem with this is I'm not a doctor. So I look at this and I go, oh, my blood pressure is very high today. Panic. stupid because it might just be high at that moment. Maybe you ate something. Or
At that very second, it could be completely different 2 minutes later.
Right. So you have to do this, you know, with some understanding of what you're doing.
Yeah.
We go into WebMD, you type in some symptoms, and you literally think you're going to drop dead 5 minutes later.
Oh, yeah. It's a horrible dark place.
Don't go on the internet and try to be a doctor. People study for years to be doctors.
Also, you take the joy away from them. This is now what I've learned. When you self-diagnose.
Take the joy away from the doctors?
Yeah, when you get there and you say, I have a plantar fasciitis and I need some treatment for that. So can you please give me a boot and I know that I'll need to ice for 3 months. They're like, oh, I was going to tell you that.
And you deflate them.
Yeah.
All right, but what new devices are there?
Well, for 2019, the focus is not so much on the body for wellness, but all on the face.
Ooh.
Okay. So it's all about perfect skin.
Oh, okay. You've seen my interest.
Sinus relief. And you've heard of Roomba vacuum cleaners, right? I've got one.
What is a Roomba vacuum cleaner?
That round robotic flat disc of a vacuum. Yeah, that does its own thing around the house. And terrorizes the cats at the same time.
Didn't know it was called the Roomba.
So the focus in 2019, these are like the most exciting wellness devices or objects that are driven by artificial intelligence and 3D printing, etc.
Okay.
So the first one is the Opte Precision Skincare System. It's a device that looks nothing bigger than a men's shaver. And if you are looking for really good skin and you're tired of putting on foundation and concealer, this promises, it's by Procter & Gamble, it promises flawless skin, and apparently it actually works.
How?
It uses a blue light or blue light to scan your face for imperfections like age spots and immediately applies formula to just that small area that needs it.
Oh, I want to know what that formula is.
The before and afters apparently were astonishing.
I looked at myself in the mirror the other day and I thought, definitely getting older. Need to do something. I mean, I go, you know, I get this face treatment thing every, couple of months.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I think it's helping, but I'm definitely not enjoying the way I'm looking. Need to do something.
Well, I must tell you, you know, you and I being the same age and obviously seeing the same sort of signs appear at
526 years old.
12 years old. Mm-hmm. I happen to work in the beauty industry with a lot of beauty clients. Mm-hmm. And I've always really found products in each of the brands that works really well. And I now have found a brand that works really well.
Mm.
So come to me for advice if you'd like to know.
Because you've got pretty good skin.
Yeah.
Don't have a lot of wrinkles.
No.
No.
You still have elasticity in your skin as well. That's a big thing.
So Leanne has the secrets to eternal youth. After 526 years, she's finally found it.
Maybe I should charge for the results.
Yeah,
maybe
you should.
Okay,
maybe get some advice here.
Maybe I'd be willing to pay.
Yeah. So the next sort of artificial intelligence device is called the Neutrogena Mask ID Custom Sheet Mask.
Jesus.
So these sheet masks are the whole new rage, right?
I've
especially
seen those. Yeah.
Mostly starting off from K-beauty or Korean beauty. That's where it kind of really grew legs. So this is a sheet mask that you put on. It's being released early this year. It always comes to South Africa, but later than the international. Mm-hmm. And it's a service that sends you these sheet masks that are shaped and formulated specifically for your face. You scan your face with a phone, and then Neutrogena will 3D print, fill, and deliver a sheet mask design just for you.
Hmm.
So it'll pick up the exact zones of your skin that you need help on, etc.
All right.
The next one is the La Roche-Posay My Skin Track. That's already out overseas, due to come to South Africa soon. It's a tiny little tab that you stick onto your skin.
Yes.
You know, usually you define your skin as oily, dry, combination, etc.
Sure.
But it's actually quite difficult to figure out exactly what's going on. So this is like a small fingernail-sized patch that you put onto your skin. It connects to an app, and that recommends products based on your pH levels.
Okay. Well, I suppose everybody's different, so you can't have there's not this one size fits all treatment, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
The next one is the Clear UP sinus pain relief
Clear
device.
Clear UP.
Yeah, I just realized
that. It's like Yoda taking a look at your urine sample. Clear UP.
And it is a declogging device, which also, yeah.
Declogging.
So this is shaped almost like a beauty blender, which is...
a beauty blender?
Beauty blender, those sponges which you apply your foundation with.
I don't know about those.
It's almost like a teardrop-shaped sponge. One pointy end and a bulb at the other.
Okay.
So it's a device that looks like that, except it's made of plastic. Getting gross for a second, your sinuses are supposed to produce mucus, right?
Mucus, yes.
But if you have a cold or allergies or other environmental factors that are going on, they can
get clogged.
Or you've got
a bad, you get a bad diet, that can also make your
bad
sinuses
diet,
clog up, right?
Maybe you've even just got bad plumbing in there.
Sure.
You know, and you often take medication. But now this device... it's a little handheld device, uses microcurrent technology to identify and declog sinuses, relieves pain almost instantly.
That sounds good.
It's so good because the medicines that you take for sinusitis have a lot of side effects.
And you've got your noses running and it's just horrible. Mm-hmm. It's a horrible thing. That whole area, those sinuses are just a problem.
Leads to chest infections.
Yeah.
And the last device is like a Roomba for your mouth. It's called the Oral-B Genius X toothbrush. Electric toothbrush looks pretty much stock standard. Mm-hmm. However, this one is a smart toothbrush, uses AI to give you feedback on your brushing. So it'll let you know when you're applying too much pressure.
But I've kind of got that already.
Does it let you know?
An electric toothbrush, and when you push too hard, it goes red instead of blue.
Okay. This one also tells you which teeth you didn't brush well enough.
I think this one does that too.
Really?
I think so.
Do you maybe have the Oral-B Genius X toothbrush? It's not yet available.
I might have it. I might actually have that.
Well, let's see. It's supposed to come out in September.
I think I might have an advanced copy.
Look at that. Maybe you got it from Hong Kong or something.
Probably. It's probably some, yeah. Look. These days, these toothbrushes are really smart. What I want is something that can do what it has to do while you're sleeping. Imagine that.
I'm telling you, you'll notice.
Well, I don't know. There's got to be some way that we
can... That car wash going on in your mouth, is not. Yeah. You're not going to sleep through that.
I don't know. I think that it's like oral health is just so gross. I just find the whole thing just gross.
Yeah, it's not
what
great.
Do you mean?
Just like people with their teeth and their breath
people
and their
people smushing plaque all over and...
Don't you find it gross?
Spitting into basins. It's disgusting.
Yeah. No, I actually find it... I could brush my teeth, not even joking, on an average day like 3 times.
Yeah, yeah.
Ordering on 4 times.
That's what I'm
saying. It excites
me. It's just a gross... The whole procedure and people like... Bad morning breath and... Oh my God.
Think of the after effects of... Squeaky clean teeth.
No, I like that. I'm totally with you on that front. What I'm saying is there's got to be some mechanism by which we can keep our mouths clean the whole time.
Not a
like
basic
after I've had a cup
spitting.
Of coffee, I want to go and brush my teeth. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Mm.
After every meal, I want to go and brush my teeth. And you can't brush your teeth that often.
There just isn't time.
Well, there isn't time, but it's also not good to do it that often. Dentists will tell you that. Anyway, this just you know what the whole thing with the teeth and the saliva and the tongue and it's just gross, just gross. It's revolting.
We're right. Humans. What can
I
we
know,
do?
Gosh, please. All right. So there's apparently a new $12 billion airport that is going to be the biggest one in the world. Where are they building that?
Maybe you should try and guess.
Okay, let's guess.
Let me tell you that it's already in operation, but only part of it is in operation. Once it's at its full capacity and all the wings have been built, then it'll be the biggest
all
in
right,
the
well,
world.
Don't give us too many clues. Let's go. All right, see how you can guess first.
12 billion.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the east.
Yes, that's what I would have guessed in China.
Somewhere in the east. I don't know. That's as good as my guess.
A little further west than the east.
Really?
Dubai, Abu Dhabi,
now we're looking
Qatar.
Closer. Uh-huh.
Oh, and they have the World Cup coming. So maybe this is all part of, you know, preparing for that.
All right, go on. Tell
it
us.
It's in Turkey.
Oh. Huh?
It's Turkey? Called Istanbul New Airport.
All right.
It replaces Istanbul Atatürk Airport.
Yeah, you know who Atatürk was.
One more time, Leanne.
Atatürk.
Muhammad Atatürk.
Atatürk.
No, Atatürk.
It's Atatürk.
No, it's not.
It is Atak.
Stop saying Atak. You're going to give the wrong command and then the army attacks.
It's Atatürk.
Atatürk. That's a misspell on that stupid site you're on.
What is
Atatürk? Perhaps. Was the first. He was the first president of an independent Turkey after the Ottoman Empire.
Well, that airport ceased operations a while back. It was one of the busiest, mm-hmm. with 70 million annual passengers, and now this one.
This one's open already?
It's opened. It opened in October 2018. The first phase of construction, which is three runways and 15 million square feet of terminal space, is finished. There are four phases to be completed by 2025. That's just 5 years away, at a total cost of $12 billion. And it will then be able to handle 200 million passengers a year.
So the biggest airport in the world.
So by comparison, Hatfield-Jackson International Airport in Atlanta is currently the busiest airport in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That handles 107 million passengers a year. So this will be double. Double.
That's a lot of people, huh?
Double and Atatürk.
It's going to have
$1 billion.
Amazing features as well. The duty-free areas inspired by the Bosphorus. That's an underwater waterway in Turkey. It'll have seven sections housing different concepts, including fashion garden, family palace, style beach.
Wow.
All these theme-related.
Sounds like some people go there just to be at the airport.
Or to go to the hotel, 451-room boutique hotel that has landside and airside access.
Mm. All right. Stop talking like that. You're getting me excited.
Too much to handle.
All right. Very, very good. Now, listen, we've got a guest in the studio I think you're going to be interested in hearing from. His name is Adrian Stern. He is a docu-journalist and conservationist. Hey, Adrian, how are you?
Very well. How are you?
Good, man. I was reading about you. You've done some pretty amazing stuff. Let's get into this and let people know. You're a photographer and filmmaker. You have just been recently acknowledged by the Queen for your outstanding service and inspirational work campaigning for wildlife.
Did she say, oh, well done, oh, very well done. Good of you to look after the planet.
I didn't get to meet her. I didn't go over for the award, but...
you didn't meet her.
No, I assume she was polite, whatever she said.
Yeah.
Oh, how very... Well, your head didn't even pitch, son of a bitch.
Australian, yeah.
All right, so you're Australian-born, but you've adopted South Africa as your home country. And you were just recognized by the Queen as the 91st Commonwealth Point of Light for your outstanding service and inspirational work campaigning for conservation. So I was reading about you, and apparently in 2018... You were the guy who got the worldwide acclaim and recognition for a brave three-month undercover mission, which uncovered a poaching and smuggling syndicate, which was linked to the direct, was linked directly to the former First Lady of Zimbabwe, Grace Mugabe. And obviously, you gathered documents and undercover videos, testimonies, and they were all showed to Al Jazeera's investigative unit. And since then, over 300 kilograms of illicit ivory has been seized by the authorities, and a police investigation against Grace Mugabe is currently underway. Mm. So well done on that front.
Wow.
That's not messing around.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing's quite complicated, but yeah, it was interesting process to understand the corruption that is endemic, I guess, with a lot of these African countries. And it's one of those things where people are happy to call out the poachers and say, hey, we shot a poacher, or raise funds for our anti-poaching fund because we're taking out these people in the field. But nobody really wants to make a call on the syndicates because the syndicates are so sophisticated, politically connected.
Yeah, and they're often more dangerous people than the poachers.
Oh, completely. The poachers, nobody grows up wanting to be a poacher.
No. So first of all, while we're talking about poachers, I just wanted to hear your thoughts on a poacher who was killed in the Kruger National Park this week. Apparently an elephant trampled him and then he was eaten by lions. Is that a victory for the animals?
Oh, yeah. I guess, you know. I guess it is, but it's again, it's one of these things. You go live on the Mozambican border, and you're one of 11 kids, and your mother's a widow, and you've got no money. You didn't get to finish school. You'd probably end up poaching too.
Yeah,
that is what it is. So I, you know, to sit there, and look, the whole thing's a pantomime in many ways, where people raise money in the first world saying we're doing this, this and this. The reality of the situation is that we need to confront this holistically. I'm not one of those righteous people. I'm not an activist, none of the above, but I am quite practical about what's going on, and it's not working. Conservation globally isn't working. We need to rebrand it. It can't just be a white person's game who owns Mercedes-Benz station wagon with a couple of Labradors and a bird book. It can't be that anymore. It's not working. Yeah.
So what is working? I mean, you've had enough experience, you've seen enough, spoken to enough people. What do you think is working, and how do we change it?
I think we need to integrate economically. We need to integrate our big corporates, because that's where the money is. These guys control governments. We need to integrate them into a conservation space. And part of that is understanding that human beings are self-serving. To have Audi involved in conservation, there has to be an upside for Audi. That's just the basic economics of it. And I think should is a very dangerous word in the English language, to turn around and say you should clean your room. You should not go through the red light. You should not drink and drive. You should get home early from work.
Mm-hmm.
We should do a lot of things.
Yeah, so what? It doesn't mean we do.
Exactly right. It means sweet F.A., which is an Australian expression.
Yeah, I got you.
And
say it over here, bud.
But at the end of the day, and it comes with compromise. The biggest challenge we face, and this is something that nobody wants to talk about. People turn around and want to talk about poaching on the ground, mm-hmm. on the Kruger border. But let's talk about population growth.
Yeah.
There's going to be 11 billion people on our planet.
Right, and we're squeezing the animals into smaller and smaller spaces.
100%.
And we're destroying their habitats because we want resources. We want wood and we want stone and we want minerals and we want every possible thing we can pull out of the ground.
Exactly right. We want sushi. We want to have three kids. We think that we're going to have a life like the previous generation, and that's just not correct. If we want to be sustainable, we want to live here, we have to make compromises, and those compromises are going to affect us. I live in Cape Town when I'm in South Africa, and we got told there was a drought.
Mm-hmm.
We said, oh, there's a drought coming. Isn't that terrible? That's all good. I live in Camps Bay and have a shower, and then the drought comes, and then the water shortages start, and then the water stops coming out of the tap. And then you go, oh, there really is a drought.
So only when it affects us do we actually start to care.
Of course, that's just the way it works.
But you see, this is the big problem with conservation, is for most people, they don't even encounter it in their daily lives, so they don't think about it, so they don't care about it. And making people who are not fans of wildlife and nature, the kind of people who would probably buy photographs of yours and watch your films, you're preaching to the choir on those formats, right?
That's exactly right.
People who don't care don't care.
Getting in a room with badly dressed conservationists and wealthy donors who are all nodding is not going to save our planet. So we need to integrate the message. We need to understand that the single parent in Khayelitsha does not give a flying about
shit
a polar
about
bear.
It, yeah. Or a rhino.
Exactly. It means nothing. It's just meaningless. So to turn around and be righteous is not going to work. So how do we make it tangible? How do we integrate the natural world into our children's lives at an early age? We've got kids now who are going to meet their partners on a phone. They're going to meet their partners on a phone. They're going to the only rhino they're going to see is in virtual reality.
But here's another thing that I've realized, in South Africa in particular. There are organizations, there are companies, there are individuals, non-government organizations that look after conservation efforts and animals and, you know, making sure that there are reserves and that these animals are looked after, that they're counted, that they're cared for, that there are vets, that there are anti-poaching units, all this kind of stuff. And they are often compared to charities that look after people. And some people believe you can only be one, you cannot be both. But actually, if we don't look after both, there's going to be none for anybody.
Completely agree. Integrated right. approach is the only way. You cannot tell the community living on the fringe of a wildlife conservancy that, hey, you cannot go and hunt a kudu anymore because that makes you a poacher. 100 years ago, they were a hunter. They've been doing it sustainably for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. We collectively killed everything. We collectively put roads everywhere. We started mining. We created an abundance of us. And mm-hmm. in doing so, are now turning around and telling people who are living on the borders of these national parks that you can't do that, you shouldn't do that. And we need to understand that to turn around and shake our heads righteously and say, oh, can you believe that they poached the impala to eat?
Meanwhile, you've got you're driving around in your people-carrying vehicle with like 10 kids in it.
Precisely.
Yeah. Like, people these people are killing the rhinos. They're such terrible people.
It's the elephant in the room. There's a case to, you know, you've got in this generation, you're having 4, 5, 6 kids, you're doing more harm.
I've said it's environmental terrorism.
Precisely. But nobody wants to say it because we think as human beings, it is our right. We have convinced ourselves, the narrative we have created, it is our right. And we've done, if you look at what we've done with religion, and I'm not going to obviously cause World War III here, but monotheism has replaced polytheism. We used to worship many gods and goddesses. We integrated our natural world into our daily life. So the sky, the ocean, the goddess of the hunt.
The animals, yeah. the trees.
Now yeah. God is a reflection of man, not the feminine, yeah. man as well. So yeah, now we've correct. Got male leaders. Mm-hmm. We've got a son of God, whichever religion, you know, many of these religions are different, but, you know,
talk about
Muhammad, Jesus, sure. yeah, it's always a masculine. And I can tell you that a rational decision or a really, really informed decision, my mother is less likely to send my brother and I off to war than my father. Mm-hmm. So who would I prefer leading strategically the family unit? The maternal, the mother.
Sure.
And we have taken that away from us. And it's not about this, forget about Me Too, forget about all these things. From a practical perspective, losing female leadership has been an enormous loss to our society over thousands of years, and we need to reintegrate that back.
So what do you think is being done at the moment that is actually good? There are lots of people who are involved in conservation who are doing their best. They're trying very hard. There are vast amounts of money that are raised in, as you say, the first world to come and hopefully be spent on good projects in the third world. But what do you say is actually working? I mean, where can we take lessons from and hopefully build on?
Well, the thing I would say is this, that there's a lot of people doing a lot of good things. Unfortunately, there's limited resources and conservation is a discretionary spend. So if you've ever been to a fundraiser, there'll be 2 pangolin charities and then one donor. As soon as the donor looks left, one pangolin charity is in the donor's ear saying, don't give them any money. They, you know, they use their pangolins as a soccer ball. And then, a bit confused, walks over to the other one and they say, no, you mustn't speak to them. They sexually assault their pangolins. You know, and there's only so much money. It's a discretionary spend.
Yeah.
There's only so much money to go around. So we need to look at how we integrate our day-to-day. If you look at 2 very positive stories, and they come from unlikely locations. One is the TMZ between the 2 careers. Okay? Mm-hmm. 4 kilometre between the borders between South and North Korea, and simply because we have left it alone, it has now become one of the biodiversity hotspots on our planet. Ammo leopard, amazing birds have come back.
First thing, get humans out.
Get humans out. We need to understand that us touching things up will F things up, right? Mm-hmm. 1. 2, you look at another very interesting case study, the Somali pirates.
Yes.
The Somali pirates are an unlikely conservation group because it has actually
pushed fishermen away.
Pushed big ships away because it just became too dangerous. Now, all of a sudden, it's a biodiversity hotspot up there. So, any Somali pirates tuning in this morning, I want to say thank you very much.
First time they've got a shout out.
Arr.
Yeah. but these are the things that I guess unlikely, but just it. It is quite a positive thing to hear that if you leave it alone, nature will come back. Okay, so we want to manipulate, we want to control. We only feel comfortable if we're in control, if it's our idea. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that we just need to understand is that if we minimize our contact, if we reintegrate ourselves, if we understand that the less of us, the more success we will have in the long run as a species, then these are very important things to take on board. But we also have to relook at the narrative that we've created around ourselves as a species, which is we have a right to have children. That's us as humans. You know, at the end of the day, we're animals, and we're here to perpetuate our species, and we're massively effective at it.
Yeah, we're the most successful animal in evolutionary history, as far
But there's a tipping point, because we'll very soon become the least successful animal in evolutionary history unless we make change. And this change is about not being politically correct. It's saying things that people don't want to talk about, but saying it in a very constructive way.
Stop having so many fucking children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's right? that. Yeah, but you go say that in the wrong environment. You go say that in the southern states of America, and you'll have rocks thrown at your head.
Yeah.
And so it's one of these things where we need to be less politically correct. We need to be more understanding. But I think one of the big things that I sort of subscribe to is to be brave enough not to be certain. As soon as you're certain about something, we make mistakes. We go to war. We fuck it up. Okay.
So to
be brave enough to turn around and say, we are not entirely sure, but we're going to constructively look at this. We're going to make decisions together. And of course, what I'm talking about is utopian. But I'm telling you now,
it's something to work towards.
Yeah, it is
even
something.
Even if we get 10% of it right, we'll save a whole bunch of the planet.
Precisely.
So tell me quickly, what is Beautiful News?
Beautiful News is a good news platform for South Africa. We started it 2 years ago. I ran a project called 21 Icons before that. And that was very successful. Went to around 300 and 400 million people around the world. And the narrative for that project was, there's more to South Africa than just Nelson Mandela.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I came here as an Australian. Obviously, Nelson Mandela is a huge presence. I was fortunate enough to meet him, photograph him, interview him. But one of the big things that I was asked as an Australian was, why did you move there? What future does this country have? So 21 Icons was the genesis. We moved into Beautiful News, which was more about the everyday person, the positive stories. Every single day, we created a film. And this is, we're now into our third year, I think. And literally, people asked us, is there a good news story every day in South Africa? And it's, again, we blame society. We are society. Okay? I could have gone through every red light from Parkhurst to here this morning, but I chose not to. No,
well, thank you for that, because otherwise there'd be a bunch of dead people.
Yeah. But the point is, we self-govern. We make decisions here. We are the community.
Right.
And I have never been to a place around the world, and I travel a lot, where the human spirit is just more exuberant, more present than South Africa, because we don't have the day-to-day governmental control. There is no net below us. So we have to help each other, stand shoulder to shoulder. And in this community, if we don't, and if you're not going to add value to this country and you're going to be negative about it, then I suggest you get on a boat.
Right.
Leave. Because it doesn't matter gender, sexuality, passport, it makes no difference. If a Nigerian cross-dresser is the best person to be president of this country, so be it. Add value or leave.
Right, I couldn't agree more.
Is my view. And so this whole thing about xenophobia, this whole thing about corruption, we need to fix it. We blame society, we blame the government, we're responsible for it. And rather than turn around and isolate yourself and take sides, take somebody with you and say, hey, look, there's so much good here, and I've watched positivity create positivity, momentum creates momentum, and this Beautiful News has gone around the world. So we've told 800 stories. We've had a reach of 1.6 billion. We've had a couple of hundred million views. It's been in the New York Times. It's been absolutely everywhere. And again, why? It's disruptive, because the narrative we've created here in South Africa is that Johannesburg, oh my God, you need a bulletproof vest to live in Johannesburg, where it's bullshit. Okay, there are challenges here, but it's a vibrant, happening place. It's one of the coolest cities on the planet. I don't live here. I don't have a passport. I don't have to say it. I don't rely on the government for anything. I'm just telling you now, we get to choose our own narrative. And that's what Beautiful News is about, is choosing the narrative of positivity, understanding that there are people doing really, really, really good things to survive every single day. Necessity is the mother of invention, and South Africa needs things. And in doing so, we create levels of community that I haven't seen anywhere else.
Fantastic. I think that might be the finest compliment we've ever been paid.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Thank you for that.
All right, so Adrian, just quickly, something that's kind of simplistic, but I'm interested anyway. What's your favorite animal to photograph, to film? Over the years, what have you enjoyed doing the most?
I do find honey badgers quite amusing.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, they're just, I mean...
Especially if Aussie man's revering them.
Oh, mate, what are those things? Yeah. I mean, you can't kill them. It's an, yeah, extraordinary little animal.
It's made out of barbed wire. And
there was that, there's that YouTube series on the little one who was escaping the whole time.
Yeah, hilarious. Stoffel or something.
Stoffel.
Yeah, yeah. That, I mean, that thing, you can just watch it over and over and over again. It'll make you smile.
Yeah.
Just tell me about pangolins, because you mentioned them earlier, and Sia was horrified that you were talking about sexually assaulting pangolins. Obviously, you
I have not done that for a long time.
Okay.
For a long time.
I know it's wrong now.
Okay.
Yeah. But pangolins...
Education is very important.
That's
pangolins are very strange little animals, and they're obviously under huge threat. People eat them?
People eat them? Look, here's the thing, and this is another really... confronting piece. We turn around, we blame the East, we blame China. I've sat down with triads, with the groups of people who take these countries, the Horn, etc., out of this country, and you'll say, it's wrong, you shouldn't do that. Mm. And then one of them will look at you in the eye and say, well, you people try to tell us that Jesus walked on water.
Yeah.
He said, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
Yeah.
So don't tell us what we're doing is wrong. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's shelf that for a second. Practically speaking, as environmentalists, we require biodiversity. So whether it's wrong or whether it's right, whether it's wrong to eat a pangolin but right to eat a goat or a cow, that's a moral debate that we can have for 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, we need biodiversity. And as soon as you wipe out a species in an ecosystem, the ecosystem starts to crumble. As if the ecosystem starts to crumble, the biome suffers, we suffer.
Right.
So if we can link these... the plight of these animals back to our own survival, then conservation, in inverted commas, has a future. If we can't, at this stage, it's a discretionary spend. So pangolin, I did a series on pangolin called Pangolin Men 3 years ago. So it's these handlers in Zimbabwe who look after these pangolin. And narrative is everything.
Sure.
Before we shot that, they were a couple of Shona guys who sort of shuffle around in the dirt and feed pangolin ants. An anteater. No one cared. We create a narrative around what they do, and before you know it, it's appearing in the New York Times. It's appearing in London. It's appearing absolutely everywhere. So yeah, narrative...
You've made these things celebrities.
Yeah, exactly. Narrative is absolutely everything. So we need to get this right. We need to reshift the narrative of conservation. And as long as it remains righteous or socks with sandals, we're not going to hit 90% of our population. We need to make change.
Well, thank you for coming to spend some time with us this morning. It's an absolute pleasure to get to know you, and I wish you well. I hope that there's much good news and positivity that comes out of this. I think beautiful news is a great place to start. And for those people who are interested in more, you can find Adrian all over the media, and hopefully we'll be hearing a lot more from you in the next couple of months.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Good stuff. Adrian Stan, and he is a docu-journalist and conservationist, among other things. Also, straight talker, which we love and appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
All right, very good. On the way, we're going to give you episode 9 of Blind History, featuring Mother Teresa this morning. On the 4th of September 2016, His Holiness Pope Francis canonized an Albanian Indian Roman Catholic nun and missionary in a ceremony in St. Peter's Square in the Vatican City. Tens of thousands of people witnessed the ceremony live, including 15 government delegations and 1,500 homeless people from across Italy. It was televised live on the Vatican Channel and streamed online. In India, where she had worked, a special mass was celebrated by the Missionaries of Charity in Kolkata. History will remember her as Mother Teresa, and she remains in death as in life, a controversial figure. Anthony, Medera and I are back with more Blind History. If you've missed any of the episodes up to now, shame on you. Shame. We've done so many and there are many more to come. Today, Mother Teresa. How excited are you about talking about Mother Teresa?
Oh, very. It's very polarizing. It's very interesting. If we talk about when she became a saint, but then you look at how many people actually came to her funeral, I believe there weren't a lot.
I'll quote some stuff from one of the books that I've read that is in my library at home that isn't exactly kind about her, but we have to admit that this woman made an enormous impact on the world. Her name, her real name, Anes Gonya Boyache. That's how you'd pronounce it. She was born in Skopje, which is now in Macedonia. And then she moved to Ireland for a little while and became a nun. She was always very religious. She, at an early age, was fascinated by missionaries. And she used to tell her mother that's all she wanted was to dedicate her life to Jesus and to spreading the word of Jesus and to doing good work as a religious nun. And when she was in Ireland, she joined the Loretta convent there and the sisters. And then she decided she actually wanted to go to India because India had the most poor people. There was this this tension between the various religious sects in India. She felt the poor in India were the poorest of the poor. And she was actually the person who patented that poorest of the poor saying. And decided to head off. And upon doing so, by the way, when she moved to India, that was the last time that she saw her mother or sister ever again. Her father died when she was only 8 years old. So she just abandoned that family for a religious family.
Her mother had a big influence in her life. Right through her life, she kept referring back to her mom because it was a very politically fierce area they were living in. If you look at the Albanians and the Serbs and that type of rivalry and war. And the dad was quite political.
Apparently, yeah. Apparently he was in politics.
So he was in politics. And also you can see through her life, she has a little bit of that from her dad that she definitely inherited. After her dad passed away, obviously then they became very poor. But her mom would invite anybody and everybody to the dinner table. Didn't matter if they were Serbs or Albanians, whatever it might be, anybody.
Well, no wonder they were poor.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
When she moved to India, she also took on the name of her patron saint, her favorite saint, which was Teresia de Lisieux, who was the patron saint of missionaries. And she then changed her outfit as well to the famous one that we've all seen, the white cotton sari with the blue border that became the uniform of the missionaries of charity. And that was kind of her presentation. And maybe this is something that you rightly point out she could have got from her dad, this idea of how to present yourself almost politically.
100% agreed. But her time there initially, Gareth, I think, was to teach. And she actually taught rich children rather than, or let's rather say, well-off children. And just across the fence were what they would call the untouchables. And you could see that she had almost a different career after this particular career in teaching. She wanted to go to the poor, and that's when she started the Missionaries of Charity. But initially, she was teaching and then became the principal of this Catholic school, which ultimately, that wasn't her vision.
That's an important word, vision, because at that stage, there were obviously a lot of religious people doing good work, but she somehow managed to turn that into something that had international attention and acclaim. And we'll go through some of the things that she was involved in internationally in a moment. But I thought it was interesting when she founded the Missionary of Charity, obviously there were a very small group of nuns. Ended up being, by 2012, 4,500 nuns and in 133 countries. Now, whether or not you like Mother Teresa or whether or not you think that she was a pure philanthropist or an altruist, the fact is if you can create that kind of groundswell of support and you can get that many people dedicating and devoting their lives to a cause which didn't exist before you came along, I think that deserves a lot of credit.
It definitely does. She built a massive brand. I think she was quite aware of that.
So they built these homes of the dying, and nuns would take vows of chastity, poverty, and obedience. And eventually, she was acknowledged early in the 1960s by a lot of people, and she started to make public appearances and started to speak about poverty and about hospice and about death and these kinds of things. But she eventually received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1979, which was a bit of a turning point because from there on her fame and acclaim grew. And she's always been referred to by a lot of people as this apotheosis of a good person, that this is someone who dedicates themselves to others, who gives, who doesn't care about receiving. Those were largely the opinions of the majority of people who knew that she existed, the opinions of her that people held.
Yeah, it's exactly right. I think during her lifetime, particularly in that period, I mean, she was revered. And it's only later on stories came out that maybe, she received millions of dollars in terms of donations for the missionaries of charity all around the world, exactly what you had said earlier. And, you know, there's claims that only 7% actually went to those missionaries or to those orphanages or dying houses.
So maybe this is an appropriate place to bring in Christopher Hitchens' book, Missionary Position, which is the book where he kind of tears apart the reputation of Mother Teresa. He called her a fanatic, a fundamentalist, and a fraud. He said she was not a friend of the poor, but she was a friend of poverty. She would take money from people, as you've already indicated, the Duvaliers of Haiti, who were a dictatorial family who had done nothing but oppress the people of that island. Charles Keating from Lincoln Savings and Loan, who'd stolen millions of other people's money. She used that to build 200 convents in her own name. And this is not someone who's not interested in anything for themselves. If you build 200 convents in your own name, that indicates a little bit of ego, if nothing else. And it wasn't modesty or humility, according to Hitchens. She didn't believe in the empowerment of women or female reproductive rights at all.
Well, that was scary, Gareth. I mean, it's from that perspective.
She said that contraception was murder, not even abortion. And she was so opposed to contraception in a part of the world where a lot of women had no control over their reproductive rights at all, where men would decide for the women that they were to be beasts of burden and to be beasts of reproductivity for their lives and would be thrown into this never-ending cycle of just making children, which is obviously the recipe for the opposite of the emancipation of women from poverty. And his criticism of her extended to her preachments, which he says led to worse, not better lives than they might otherwise have had for the people in her care, and that she was obsessed with death, that the houses of the dying almost became a death cult, where people weren't really interested in helping you, rescuing you, saving you, curing you, and removing you from what would have become an obvious death, but rather just to help you get there quickly so that you could be saved by God at the end, so that you could make your peace and just go.
Saving souls in the name of the Catholic Church, even for those people that didn't necessarily want to be part of the Catholic Church.
And as you indicated, only 7% of what she's supposed to have brought in went to the people who she was supposedly raising this money for. In fact, they say even worse is the fact that all of this money went straight to the Vatican, that her loyalty to Rome was almost paramount to everything else.
Yeah. I don't think the Vatican is poor, that's for sure.
So here are a couple of quotes from her, and this kind of maybe hints at what Hitchens always criticized her for. A beautiful death, she said, is for people who lived like animals, to die like angels, loved and wanted. So it didn't matter that you were poor and miserable and hungry. As long as you died in her arms or the arms of the missionaries of charity, everything would be okay at the end. Which is a little fatalistic.
Yeah.
She said, by blood, I am an Albanian. By citizenship, I am an Indian. By faith, I am a Catholic nun. As to my calling, I belong to the world. And she actually died 5 days after Princess Diana, who was a friend of hers. They used to be in correspondence. They were both regarded as these women of charity and women who cared more about the poor and the downtrodden than anyone else. Do you know how many languages she spoke?
No, I don't.
Five.
Okay, good.
Not bad. Yeah. Bengali, Albanian, Serbian, English, and Hindi.
Didn't she take a while to learn Bengali?
I think it took, a fairly long time, but that's five more languages than most of us.
Yes, exactly.
Give her credit for that.
Yeah, 100%.
Anyway, she is now Saint Teresa.
Yes.
So there's another Saint Teresa. There are now two. And she was canonized in that famous ceremony by Pope Francis, who's the current pope. And she's held in great esteem by many Catholics and people in secular charity all over the world.
The sainthood from basically curing two people, a lady and a man, of the tumor.
That's right. Now, this is interesting because in order to be canonized as a saint, apparently you have to perform miracles.
Exactly, yeah.
And in her case, that's exactly what she's supposed to have done with these two people. The one guy was someone in South America who she apparently laid hands on and his tumor was cured. And the other one was this woman who you spoke of.
But I think the one was after her death, and there was just a locket with a picture of her on the chest. So I'm not sure if it was the man or the woman, but there was a locket on this particular person's chest, and they were cured.
Do you know that the job of devil's advocate is an actual job?
Okay.
In the Vatican, there's an actual they hire a person who is critical of someone as a devil's advocate, who is called in to present the case against
the canonization. Or, yeah. Yes.
And that's actually someone who is called in, different people are called in different times to present all the facts that prove that this person should not be canonized. Mm. So it's an actual job. You can say, I was devil's advocate for X, Y, and Z, which is fascinating.
And I wonder what the devil's advocate was saying about this particular canonization. I mean,
there are still huge controversies around what she's done. And obviously, since her departing, the Missionaries of Charity have continued. But obviously, without her at the head of it, and the enormous PR machine that she constructed around herself and that was constructed in her name around her, it doesn't necessarily have the kind of influence that it might have had in the years gone by.
If we look at the description of some of her orphanages and dying houses, one person likened it to a type of concentration camp, and needles were reused. Training was not up to standard. It was scary places.
You weren't going in there to get better.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the mortality rate was 40%. She had heart problems in the last decade of her life. And she had 3 heart attacks. And she really had the best care in America.
Yeah, she said famously, it is not how much we do, but how much love we put in the doing. It is not how much we give, but how much love we put in the giving. And that's from her writing, No Greater Love. She published in about 1990, somewhere around there. So there it is, the famous Mother Teresa, Saint Teresa. Thanks for listening to this episode of Blind History, brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters.
This is CliffCentral.com.